From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And we're following the news of the death of the suspect in last week's deadly shooting in Portland, Oregon. Michael Forrest Reinell is suspected of killing Aaron Danielson, a member of the right-wing group Patriot Prayer, last Saturday, as racial justice protesters and pro-Trump protesters clashed. Last night, Reinell was shot and killed as law enforcement officers attempted to arrest him near Olympia, Washington. They say they were forced to shoot after they say Reinell pulled out a firearm. Jonathan Levinson is a reporter with Oregon Public Broadcasting, and he's been following this story. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What else can you tell us about Reinell and briefly remind us how he encountered Aaron Danielson in Portland?
Reinell was he was 48, professional snowboarder. Up until George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis and the protests started in Portland, his social media was, about snowboarding and about nature. And then when the protests started here, there was this dramatic shift, and it appears that he had been attending the nightly protests downtown. The way he encountered Danielson, there was a Trump caravan last weekend that came through Portland. Hundreds of vehicles waving Trump flags and Thin Blue Line flags. They all poured into downtown. Fights broke out between them and counter-protesters. Some of the Trump demonstrators were shooting people with bear mace and paintball guns from their trucks. A few times they drove their trucks through counter-protesters. On the Facebook page for the event, attendees were encouraged to conceal carry. And this came on the heels of a previous week's rally that just devolved into really extraordinary violence. A lot of firearms in that crowd as well. So there was tension coming into this past weekend's protest. And as it was winding down, we know that Reinell encountered Aaron Danielson downtown. Words were exchanged, and ultimately Reinell fired two shots. One struck Danielson in the chest and killed him. Reinell then ran away. We don't know the specifics, though. We don't know, what happened, what the altercation was about, or what specifically, motivated mm-hmm. the shooting.
Portland police obtained a warrant for his arrest yesterday. Explain what happened once they located him.
Yeah, yesterday, Multnomah County judge issued the warrant. It wasn't Portland police that located him. It was just before 7 p.m., members of the Pacific Northwest Violent Offender Task Force, which is a bunch of different law enforcement agencies, were waiting outside an apartment near Olympia, Washington, where they thought Reinell was staying. They confronted him as he was getting into a vehicle, and that's when shooting began. The U.S. Marshals said that he had a gun and was threatening the lives of law enforcement. We haven't been able to confirm that. We don't know if Reinell fired at them or what exactly transpired.
So hours before Reinell was killed, Vice News published an interview conducted by freelance journalist Donovan Farley, in which Reinell seemed to acknowledge that he had shot Danielson, claimed self-defense. Let's listen.
I felt that my life and other people around me's lives were in danger. And I felt like I had no choice but to do what I did.
Why hadn't he been named a suspect or a person of interest before yesterday, publicly?
We don't really know that yet. We know that the Portland police had spoken to him earlier in the week, but they've been pretty tight-lipped during the investigation, and we don't know why a warrant wasn't issued until yesterday.
Okay. So Black Lives Matter protesters, Reinell said that he was working to protect them last weekend. Have any folks in that area said anything about this?
Yeah, I mean, there's a sense of dismay that police killed another person. There's obvious skepticism that he posed a threat to them and that, the law enforcement couldn't detain him without killing him. There are people questioning if they really intended to arrest him, saying that this amounts to a mob hit. Others are calling it tragic, saying that Reinell didn't feel safe from local police, who there's this perception they favor far-right groups to begin with. And it's tragic that ultimately law enforcement killed him.
Jonathan, with the little bit of time that I have with you, this Saturday will mark 100 consecutive days of protests there in Portland. It's a holiday weekend. There are sit-ins and other demonstrations expected. How are Portland officials preparing for what could potentially be another violent weekend?
We haven't heard anything yet. The past 2 weeks of pro-Trump rallies in Portland, the police have said that they are understaffed and don't have the numbers to have a huge presence at these rallies. In the past, when major events like this were planned, they would mobilize, you know, the entire bureau, and they get help from outside. But other agencies right now are declining to help. The mayor has asked outside groups to stay away and de-escalate. And for now, that appears to be the plan. Police haven't indicated how they might be staffing this weekend.
Jonathan Levinson is a reporter with Oregon Public Broadcasting. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we're getting reaction today to an explosive article in The Atlantic magazine. According to the editor-in-chief, Jeffrey Goldberg, the president called American soldiers killed or injured in wars losers. He objected to including veterans who'd lost limbs in a military parade and disparaged the service of former President George H.W. Bush. Last night, President Trump denied the magazine's claims.
They made it up, and probably it's a couple of people that have been failures in the administration that I got rid of, and I couldn't get rid of them fast enough, but or it was just made up.
Let's bring in veteran Paul Rykoff. He founded a group called Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, and he hosts the podcast Angry Americans. Paul, welcome. And what did you think when you saw the story in The Atlantic? Did it ring true to you?
It rang true, but it didn't surprise me. And I don't think it should surprise anybody at this point, because it's perfectly on character with who Trump is. This is a man who's attacked Gold Star parents before, and this may be an example where he just got caught saying the wrong thing and someone heard it. So I think part of this is Trump hitting a guardrail in our democracy. And behind the scenes, defense officials and military people pushing back, leaking stuff to the press, and trying to do what they can to make sure that voters are informed before they go to the polls in November.
Tell me more about that. I mean, I'm sure you have connections and insights with people who are currently in the military or who have recently left the military. What is his relationship like with the people who he commands?
It's terrible. I don't think that the military views him as a person with integrity or who upholds the values that we hold dear to military service or to our country. We've got now, you know, almost 4 years of his behavior that continues to endanger individuals and our country. His loyalty is in question. Recently, we had the issue where there was news that the Russians may be paying bounties to kill American troops. President Trump has still not condemned that story. He has still not said that people will be held accountable around the world if they put bounties on the heads of U.S. troops. So I think it's overflowing. A recent Military Times survey of active duty troops saw that Trump's support is falling. We see his support falling among Republican military and veteran voters. And I think this one really hurts him. And I think that's why you see the White House scrambling so frenetically right now to try to squash this story, because it's a real problem for them politically, and it's not going away.
Well, in fact, the administration's reaction has been very strong. And in the process of denying this story, they say that the president's done a lot for the military, including raising pay, reforming the VA. What about that? I mean, what has the president done for service members and for veterans? Does he have anything he can hang his hat on?
That is always in part true, right? I mean, he has supported military pay raises, but so has every president in modern times. He's made some progress on the VA, but when he says he fixed VA, that's about as true as saying he fixed Washington. It's a tagline. It's a throwaway line, and there's usually a true story beneath the headline that gets him a round of applause. And we've seen that what he's also doing is degrading the military in different ways. Of course, he's politicizing us in a way we've never seen before. But he's also, for example, taking money away from the Defense Department budget and sending it down to his wall. He's abandoned our Kurdish allies. He's destroyed our relationships with NATO. So these things are really deep-cutting policy problems that will resonate potentially for decades or even generations.
Look, I know you're not a media critic, but I want to ask you if it bothers you that the sources in this Atlantic story are anonymous and that, you know, potentially it could take away some of the power of this reporting, because critics might say, well, this is an election season. These are just people who are out to get the president. Do you buy that at all, considering the fact that the military is such an organization where you can't really speak out safely?
I'm a military critic, and I'm also happy to be a media critic. But it is a bit different when you're talking about the military. These are folks who can't be politicized, who have issues of national security at hand. If you think back to the case of Colonel Vindman, they saw what happens when you speak out on the record. If you testify before Congress, if you appear in uniform, you may not be protected. So I think that context is really important around this story in particular. If they went on the record, there's no doubt the president would be coming after them right now. And he's done it before. You know, he says he doesn't call folks losers, but we have tape of him calling John McCain a loser. Every time something like this happens, our enemies are celebrating. Putin loves this. Kim Jong-un loves this. They love to see a military that doesn't trust their commander in chief. And they love to see a president who continues to make America weaker. And I think that is maybe the most important part of this story that may get lost by the media.
Paul Rykoff, founder of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, also the host of the podcast Angry Americans. Paul, thanks for your time as usual.
My pleasure. If you're not angry, you're not paying attention, especially now.
An associate professor of history at George Washington University made a startling admission this week. Her entire career, she has asserted that she is Black, when actually, she's white. Jessica Krug made this revelation in an article she wrote and published on the website Medium this week, and it has spurred a lot of reaction on social media. Joining us now for our weekly social media roundup is Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hi, Tonya. This is such a peculiar story. So Jessica outs herself and she says, I have eschewed my lived experience as a white Jewish child in suburban Kansas City under various assumed identities within a blackness that I had no right to claim. Trended massively on Thursday. People didn't know quite what to make of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's very reminiscent of the Rachel Dolezal case a few years back. What are people saying about it?
So Dr. Kissy Britton knows Jessica. She says, we were friends from about 2007 to 2010-ish. She posted this in a really interesting thread on Twitter. She hung out with my now ex-husband and told us her father was from North Africa. My ex, who lived and traveled extensively for Africa, began asking questions that we never got satisfactory answers for, because all of us are thinking, how did you not know? If you look at a picture, you're thinking, how could she be Black? And then people who don't know her are having a deep, deep, deep conversation about white privilege. So here's a good example from Preston Mitchum. And Preston says that white women pretending to be Black is incredibly violent and invasive, and proves the point we often make about whiteness and white women: violent act of anti-Blackness and patriarchy. There's a deep conversation here about what does it take to take on someone's own identity, and then, of all things, teach African American history. There's a lot there. Look for her name as the hashtag, and then you can dig deep by yourself. It will take you some while.
Absolutely a deep conversation and multi-layered, as you said. Another popular conversation on social this week is the hashtag SalonGate. Democratic Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi went to a salon to get her hair done in San Francisco, and she was seen in a video not wearing a mask. And this has been a lot of fodder for her critics. What are they saying online?
They are calling her a hypocrite because she's been calling out various Republicans for not wearing masks, not taking COVID-19 seriously. And then President Trump tweets this: crazy Nancy Pelosi. She said she was set up by the beauty parlor owner when she improperly had the salon open. So there's this huge political Twitter storm about Nancy Pelosi and what she did, either breaking or bending the rules according to San Francisco's rules about what you can and cannot do during this time of COVID-19, but basically being called out as a hypocrite.
One last topic, Femi, and this is about something that's a total distraction and lots of fun, too. So R&B singers Brandy and Monica reunited on the Instagram live show Versus this week. Let's listen to a clip.
The boy is mine.
So this show took place at Tyler Perry Studios in Atlanta, who, by the way, just now has the title of billionaire. But this stream, this Versus stream, was extremely popular. What are you seeing in the numbers? And explain how this works for many people who aren't familiar with Versus.
So Versus TV is a pandemic-inspired production. Two music producers, Timbaland and Swiss Beats, got together and thought, what can we do for entertainment during this awful time of lockdown? So they came up with a live stream webcast. The idea is you have two music icons, they have a showdown, there's a live stream, the audience get to party and sing along and dance in their chairs, and there's technically no winner. But of course, in the world of social media, you have your favourite. So this week, Brandy versus Monica, they played their hits, they told stories, record-breaking views for Versus TV. They say that across all of their platforms, more than 6 million people watch this live stream event. Let me just dip into Insta, if I may, for you. Lannis Finster says, Brandy wrapped Monica's coughing with a bow. That's fighting words. That was my it favorite is. Comment.
Yeah, yeah. It and depends on which side you're on.
Yeah, they were amazing. And I'll let me leave you with this. Vuza Mez Slick says this on Twitter. They are living icons. All jokes aside, they were a part of the few that made it feel good to be a black girl turning into a black woman. Thank you, Monica and Brandy.
Yeah, I thank you too. I went back to being a 20-year-old woman again.
Oh, that was so good.
With Brandy and Monica, so good. Femi Oke is the host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English, and as always, Femi, thank you.
You're so welcome.
The term people of color is having a moment right now as a way to describe non-white people, most recently in the collective action to fight racism. But our next guest argues the term needs to die, or at least be used in the way it was intended. Damon Young is author of What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker, and in his latest piece for GQ, Damon writes about how people of color is being incorrectly used. Welcome to Here and Now, and thanks for taking on this topic.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
You know, Damon, what's interesting is that the term people of color came from black women activists back in the 1970s. It was actually a way to communicate solidarity between non-white women. But you feel that it's lost its intent, possibly. Say more.
Yeah. And before I answer this, I want to make clear that I'm not losing sleep over this term. I don't have the term people of color burning an effigy in my front lawn or anything like that. And my issue with it is actually not so much with how actual people of color use the term, but how white people use it and use it as this one-to-one substitute when they're actually specifically talking about black people.
And this came up for you during a panel you were on where someone actually from the audience asked you a question about strategies to remove disparities for people of color.
Yeah, and this was an all-Black panel, and it was about Black issues in Pittsburgh. And one of the white audience members asked about, you know, so how do you feel that people of color should... And I stopped him, like, right in his tracks, like, there are nothing but Black people here. So why are you using people of color to address us? Why would you go there?
There's been an evolution of what to call Black people specifically in this country, and it's fraught. I mean, there's the N-word, which we know, of course, Negro, colored, African-American, Black. What would you prefer to be called and why?
Black is fine. Black is quick. Black is simple.
Yeah. You know, though, the term BIPOC, which is suddenly everywhere, this term is actually meant to counter some of the problems that you have with POC because it's distinguishing Black and Indigenous people within the term. But in your piece, you say that it's an acronym so awful that I haven't even bothered to learn exactly what it stands for. When I see it, my brain just reads BMOC, Big Man on Campus. But you know what? In the spirit of why these terms were created, do you see a way for us to build solidarity through a term? Or is that even important or necessary?
Yeah, I want to be careful not to minimize the efforts of the people who are behind creating these terms, because they're created, I think, with the proper spirit. And, you know, language matters. Language, you know, language is the colonizer's most important weapon. Taking that language back and creating terms for, you know, to describe ourselves, it's vital. You know, and when I'm talking about this thing, this is a thing more that white people do. And I want to make that clear. And there are all these other ways that people say white people without actually saying white people. Real Americans, middle class voters, Southerners.
You know what? But what you bring up when you're talking about terms to describe white Americans, there's also an evolution of the term Caucasian, which is seen as inaccurate because the backstory is that there was this 18th century German anatomist who visited the Caucasus Mountains, and it's said that he was so enchanted with the people that he viewed them as the ideal form of humanity, thus the descriptor Caucasian, but it's not an accurate description of the origin of most white people. What do you think these terms tell us about ourselves and our need to categorize people?
I do recognize that these are made up terms. And since the categories do exist, we should call them exactly what they are instead of trying to euphemize, you know, our way out of them.
What considerations do you want people to make when describing a person's race? You know, I'm even thinking about the interchangeable descriptors of Latino versus Hispanic, you know, Hispanic referring to native speakers of Spanish, Latino referring to people of Latin American origin. It tells us a lot about our need to categorize, but also not differentiate. So, yeah, what considerations do you want people to make?
The simplest and perhaps the most difficult is just to ask people. And also just be honest and just be direct. Using this people of color catch-all pushes all of it together when there are important distinctions within, you know, the different people of color.
Mm-hmm. That's author Damon Young talking with us about his latest piece for GQ titled "The Phrase People of Color Needs to Die." In it, Damon writes about his dislike for the phrase as well as other racial terms like BIPOC, which stands for Black, Indigenous, People of Color. Damon, thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
We've been following the effect COVID-19 has had on the sports you watch, but what about sports you can participate in? The pandemic has halted big marathons in their tracks, but as Here and Now's Alex Ashlock reports, some are still happening virtually.
The dominoes started to fall early this year in Asia, where the virus originated. In February, Tokyo canceled its marathon, a race that typically features more than 30,000 runners. Then in the spring, something unprecedented happened.
The Boston Athletic Association, with our input and support, has determined that the traditional one-day running of the 124th Boston Marathon is not feasible this year for public health reasons.
Boston Mayor Marty Walsh announcing the first cancellation of the Boston Marathon in its more than 120-year history. London, Berlin, Chicago, and New York followed, canceling races that attract tens of thousands of runners and spectators, pumping millions of dollars into local economies. In Japan, where road racing generates some of the country's highest television ratings, just about all of this fall's marathons won't be run. Brett Larner writes the blog, Japanese Running News.
Out of Japan's 29 major marathons, those will be marathons with 5,000 or more finishers or strong elite fields. So out of those 29 marathons at that scale, 26 have canceled. So it's essentially wiped out the fall road racing season.
So what are races doing if they can't hold these big in-person events? You guessed it.
An app, a phone app, computer app that people can download.
Of course there's an app. That's Tom Grilk, CEO of the Boston Athletic Association, which starts its first ever virtual Boston Marathon tomorrow. More than 17,000 of the 30,000 runners who were supposed to run the real marathon back in April have signed up for this one. They'll run a 26.2-mile course of their own choosing, and if they're plugged into that app, it will sound like the real marathon would. Runners will upload their results when they finish, they'll receive medals in the mail, and there will be leaderboards with the fastest times. Dr. Amy Commander runs to raise money for breast cancer programs. She says this virtual marathon will be just as special as the 6 regular marathons she's run.
I am always running to honor my patients, and I'm truly inspired by my patients. And, even though I'm not going to be, you know, running through Copley Square with the same degree of crowds and enthusiasm as I usually experience, I will still have that runner's high, and I know I will still be very proud of myself.
45,000 people have signed up for London's virtual marathon next month. Chicago and New York are also offering the virtual races, but not everyone is satisfied with the virtual option. William Hegg was supposed to run Boston and New York this year. He was able to defer his New York entry to 2021, but Boston didn't allow him to do that.
I feel like, in general, you know, a virtual marathon, it really doesn't cut it to give an equitable experience for the sacrifice and training and fundraising that a lot of these folks did, and really felt like there were other options.
Tom Grilk at the Boston Athletic Association isn't so sure that's true.
Deferring in this situation simply didn't work because the future is so uncertain. This wretched COVID-19 disease makes everything uncertain. So when will we or anyone else be able to conduct a mass participation race again?
And that brings us back to Japan, where this story started. Just today, one of that country's extremely popular ekidens, or relay road races, was canceled because of the pandemic. It was supposed to be run on December 20th. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
Students are returning to college campuses across the country, and in many cases, they're bringing the coronavirus with them. In a minute, we'll hear from a student at the University of Missouri, where cases are spiking. But first, let's touch down in Oxford, Mississippi, where some students in dorms at the University of Mississippi were ordered to quarantine last week after an outbreak. Noel Wilkin is a provost and executive vice chancellor for academic affairs. Noel, welcome. And it appears that there was some confusion about the campus quarantine. The Daily Beast quoted a freshman in one of the dorms who said that when she got the news, it was, quote, insane, everyone at the same time, rushing out of their rooms, panicking, students saying they didn't know whether they should stay put inside their rooms or go home. Was the school prepared for this?
The message that they received from us was that an outbreak had occurred, and we needed to place people in quarantine so that they didn't go to class the next day. That was the key element of what they needed to know. And then we followed up with housing to have a conversation with each person to determine what their plans would be and how they would make a decision about taking our quarantine space that's available or what decision was best for them and their family. And it took us some time to get to each student and have those conversations. And so the more recent guidance from the Mississippi Department of Health, where they quarantine temporarily on the floor while we do contact tracing, has given us a little bit more ability to have those conversations and have the students understand what's taking place more quickly. But we are also looking for additional ways that we can communicate that information to them and help them to understand what their options are sooner so that the informal communication network of what people ought to do doesn't take over in that situation.
I hear you, but at this point, when we see the outbreaks that are happening on college campuses around the country and on yours, do you think it's responsible for students to even be on campus at all?
Well, I'll tell you, that's a difficult question that institutions around the country have wrestled with. On our campus, the way we handled that, when our board passed a resolution that we would resume traditional operations in accordance with public health guidance, our faculty and our university staff came together and looked at all of our course offerings and the activities that we do. This ended up with about 28% of our hours or contact hours being offered in some in-person format. And we also recognize that this transitional period, this transformative period in students' lives from high school to life is something that we play a critical role in having those conversations, we made decisions to bring people back to do those things that are best facilitated and should be facilitated in a face-to-face environment.
Is there a point, maybe a threshold of positive test, for instance, where you say, okay, this is not safe. All students will be learning remotely from here on out. Have you thought about that?
We've thought about that. of course, because we need to know what levers are available to us to mitigate the spread of the virus. Remember in the spring when the whole nation shut down and started locking down and closing establishments, the purpose of that was to mitigate the spread to the point that we would have as a nation, society, the capacity to manage the virus. And on our campus, we're doing a similar thing where we track a number of metrics to see what our capacity to handle the number of cases that might be occurring on campus so that we know that we can continue doing the important things that we need to do in a way that prevents the virus from spreading and also have the capacity to respond to the things that come up as a result of that.
Noel Wilkin, Provost and Executive Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs at the University of Mississippi. Noel, these are challenging times. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Well, there have been more than 700 confirmed student cases of the coronavirus at the University of Missouri's flagship Columbia campus since classes resumed there on August 24th. Eli Hoff is a sophomore at Mizzou, and he's also managing editor of the student newspaper, which is called The Maneater. Eli, welcome.
Absolutely happy to be on.
So the paper's most recent editorial is headlined, "We Aren't Safe Here," and then goes on to say it's only a matter of time until something terrible happens. Tell me what's going on. What's it like on campus now?
Yeah, it's been weird. And we felt like the way Mizzou was set up coming back to campus, that it was a little bit of an experiment because we as college students are socially starved, not fully mentally developed 18 to 22 year olds who just aren't going to make the best decisions all the time. And while we can blame students for that stuff, it's also not unexpected that college students are going to gather and are going to party and things like that. So that's where for us on the newspaper staff, when we wrote that, it was sort of a no-brainer that there needed to be better testing and better protocols in place surrounding this, because everyone knew what was going to happen in terms of college students gathering.
Well, let's dig into what the situation is there on campus. How widespread is the testing? If you're on campus, are you getting tested?
No, testing is extremely difficult. I know only a couple of people who have been tested since coming back, and it's because they've been directly exposed. And they've described it as having to jump through a lot of hoops. And for students without insurance, they're saying that it's free of charge. For other students, there's a $150 copay that comes with it. And there's uncertainty, too, around quarantining, the sort of if someone's roommate has potentially been exposed, should that roommate be quarantining, too, when there are roommates that are going out into the world? It's just, it's an awkward situation from that perspective.
Eli, I appreciate your self-awareness when you were saying before that young people sometimes don't make good decisions. And yeah. let's get into that a little bit, because a university spokesman has said that 330 violations of coronavirus rules have been referred to the administration. What do you know about that? And shouldn't students be taking some responsibility for the way they're behaving, regardless, as you say, whether or not their brains are fully developed?
Sure. Yeah, and there's definitely responsibility. It doesn't take a fully developed brain or really much intelligence at all to know that there's a pandemic going on and that you should wear a mask in public and follow local rules surrounding gatherings of no more than 10 people and things like that. It's really not difficult, but you still see it happen with Greek life here. It's obviously a big deal. And so during bid day and in recruitment week, there were in-person things happening that shouldn't have happened. And you hear rumors around here of, oh, there's a party at this fraternity that still managed to happen. But you see it walking around in the East Campus neighborhood here is houses right next to campus. And it's entirely college kids and rentals in there. And you walk through there and you either see parties or hear parties. They're still happening. I think a good number of students, I would probably say the majority, are taking this pretty, pretty seriously. The problem is that the majority can only do so much when there's not complete buy-in to taking this whole thing seriously.
Well, what a year 2020 is for you and your classmates. It's not just coronavirus. I see that student athletes at Mizzou have been demonstrating for racial justice already on campus this year. How do you think that this school year and this moment that we're in will affect the rest of your college career, maybe even your life? Do you think it'll have lasting impacts?
I think so. I think the pandemic will certainly change the way we think about things, and that now I'm at the point where when I see old movies or TV shows or sporting events where it's large numbers of people without masks. Now that is what's jarring to me versus seeing people in masks. And I'm sure that will take a certain amount of time to undo. And then with civil rights stuff going on here too, it's sort of a rekindling of what happened and what didn't happen in 2015 for the University of Missouri. And so just last night, like you mentioned, a group of student athletes organized a march that drew quite the crowd, everyone wearing masks and socially distanced in the stadium. But it's definitely a defining moment for a lot of us in that we are living on our own. This is our first taste of independence, which obviously leads to some questionable decision-making at times. But it's also a chance for us to come into our own as adults and take advantage of, you know, are we able to be treated like adults or do we need to be treated like kids? Because that's been a question in my mind is what's the most effective way to handle college students? Is it to treat them like adults who can handle this, or is it to sort of treat them like kids who need to be put in timeout every once in a while? And I really don't know the answer to that.
Eli Hoff, managing editor of The Man Eater, the student newspaper at the University of Missouri. I got to say, that's an aggressive name. Eli, thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Happy to be on. Have a good one.
A new documentary about a shooting that fueled America's racial reckoning is out today on Hulu. It's called The New York Times Presents The Killing of Breonna Taylor. And it opens with the 911 call Taylor's boyfriend made after she was fatally shot by police.
I don't know what happened. Somebody kicked in the door and shot my girlfriend. Oh my God.
How old is your girlfriend?
She's 26. Bring it.
For more about this documentary and how it deepens what we know about Breonna Taylor, we're joined by NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
So this hour-long documentary on Hulu brings together much of what we've known about this case, along with several new interviews. Here's Breonna Taylor's mother, Tamika Palmer, describing the moment when she was finally allowed to see the apartment where her daughter was killed.
I saw where she laid on the floor and died. It was bullet holes everywhere, in the ceiling, into the upstairs apartments, the walls, the clock, the stove, the bed. I was sorry that I wasn't there.
Yeah. Eric, how do these personal accounts add to the story that we've heard about Breonna Taylor?
Well, and I think there's been, of course, a lot of reporting about what happened. But as somebody who does follow the news, I was still surprised and really affected by some of the things in the New York Times episode here, including that tape of that 911 call that her boyfriend made. You know, you can hear in his voice that he can't believe that just out of nowhere his life has completely been turned upside down. And the episode reveals a lot. It talks about why the police targeted Breonna Taylor. They saw an ex-boyfriend of hers as a drug dealer, and they thought mm-hmm. that she, in the past, had been working with him to hide drugs. And so that's one reason why they targeted her apartment. The actual warrant that they used to break in was a no-knock warrant, but it got changed at the last minute before they went in to a warrant where they were supposed to announce themselves. Mm. And one of the officers who was involved had a very questionable history with a lot of past allegations of misconduct, the only one who's so far has been fired. So there were a lot of things that I learned about the case that I didn't know before. And to have it all presented in a televised format, which is a little easier to process sometimes and a little more emotionally touching, mm-hmm. that was really special to experience. In fact, one thing that the episode does is really flesh out who Breonna Taylor was. And we have a clip from her friend, Alicia Bowman, talking about what it felt like to lose her friend, and maybe we could play a little bit of that.
I thought maybe it'd get a little easier on us. It's actually like hurting more. I never knew I was capable of hurting like this, you know? Like, I think I need psychological help at this point about the situation. And I'm a strong person. It's got me so weak.
Mm.
Yeah.
You know,
We get to hear from those who knew her. We hear all of those details that you're talking about the case. What sort of portrait do we get of Breonna through the words of those who knew her?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that we find when a person of color is killed by police, there is an immediate attempt to quantify the life of the person who was killed. In some ways, people use that as a way to justify whether or not the killing is considered a tragedy or not. And so for the people who are close to the person who was killed, it's really important to them to humanize the person who died, and so that the public knows that this was somebody, in Breonna Taylor's case, who, you know, had designs of becoming a nurse. Her boyfriend said they had just worked out some relationship issues and they kind of felt like they were ready to commit to each other. You know, this real sense that she was sort of the life of the party whenever she was around friends. And all of this is just a way to sort of say to the world that she really did matter, that this really was a huge loss, and to humanize her so that people don't just see her as another statistic, or worse, try to demonize her life in a way to justify the actions of the police. And so that was another thing that was interesting to watch in this New York Times story, to see all these people who loved her and where her life was at when it was cut short, all to sort of give you a sense of what a tragedy this actually was.
This documentary goes along with a deeper piece of investigative work that the New York Times has done. Can you tell us a little bit about the New York Times Presents?
Sure. The New York Times began working with FX, the cable channel FX, to present a regular show called The Weekly that would sort of be their version of 60 Minutes in a way. And I'm not sure what the status of that series is. My sense is they might have canceled it. I'm not sure. But they do still have this relationship with the New York Times, where the New York Times is creating these documentaries that allows the Times to sort of take its journalism into new platforms and present something in a new way that might affect people and reach a new audience.
Very interesting, and a lot to definitely check out. That's NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans. As always, thank you so much, Eric.
All right, thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.